Welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman with Jeff Fawcett, PhD, and we come to you weekly with a critical, independent voice on the politics and practice of health. A famous food journalist, when asked what people should eat, said, "Eat food, not too much, mostly plants." That's a quote. On the surface, that sounds reasonable. However, it turns out that plants, like everything else that lives, have self-protective mechanisms to promote propagation and to prevent extinction. In the case of plants, particularly the parts that are the richest in protein and happen to be the very germ of creation, they are filled with anti-nutrients and irritants designed to prevent creatures from eating too much of them. Animals that depend mostly on plant foods have to routinely purge their systems to prevent getting sick. Incidentally, most animal vegetarians also consume insects. Now, this isn't to say that eating vegetables isn't safe. Vegetables are very balancing. They provide colorings and antioxidants that are vital to health. Problems arise when people depend on vegetable-sourced proteins alone without properly preparing them to reduce the inhibitory effects of their anti-nutrients. The food industry, additionally, has exploited our modern trend of tender-heartedness toward animals to promote highly processed plant-based protein foods. The people who suffer the most are those whose immune and gastrointestinal symptoms have already been damaged by numerous assaults. For everyone else, my advice is eat food in a wide variety, but not too much plant-based protein. Join us this hour to find out why. First, an editorial about this week's health news by Jeff Fawcett, PhD.
Thank you, Elena. Nature or nurture? Is it our heredity or our personal, social, and physical environments that have the greatest influence on our health? And, for that matter, is it nature or nurture that most affects the person each of us becomes, the person who decides what is a full, rich life? The completion of the Human Genome Project seemed to hold great promise for identifying disease risk through genetic testing. Going further, great hope was and continues to be held for personalized medicine, your genome enabling doctors to decide what drugs would work best on you. The idea was simple. Using the map of the human genome, scientists would identify specific gene variations associated with increased risk of getting a disease. This is done by comparing DNA sequences of people with specific conditions to people without them. Every week, there seems to be a new report of such associations. Last week, genes associated with increased risk for diabetes were found to be the same genes associated with a reduced risk for inflammatory bowel disease in an apparent genetic collision. With these scientific promises, a new market has developed to sell such tests directly to consumers. However, as an article in the business page of the New York Times reported recently, there aren't many customers, although hopes remain buoyant. One company is taking the clever strategy of shifting its pitch from consumers to doctors. The logic is compelling, and it's a strategy already used by the pharmaceutical and nutraceutical industry. The strategy fits well with current medical practices. In the aftermath of the recent national health care reform legislation, much has been made about provisions for prevention. These are rather sad provisions, such as requiring insurance companies to pay for free annual physicals with the usual host of screening tests, despite the dangers of overdiagnosis and overtreatment, the two factors most responsible, in my opinion, for escalating medical costs and undermining actual health. With an effective sales strategy directed at physicians, yet another layer of pseudo-prevention will be targeted at us. As we discuss in Too Much Medicine, Not Enough Health, the problem with these genetic tests is that the science has passed them by. The tests are based on the idea that a gene expresses itself by producing a protein that goes off into the body and does some piece of work, or in the case of disease, some piece of mischief. There are two aspects to this high concept that are wrong. The first is that the body has something like 500,000 distinct proteins, while the human genome consists of only about 23,000 genes. Where do all those extra proteins come from? From the action of proteins on proteins and other biochemicals on proteins. Consider a house. It's built from blueprints. The newly finished house doesn't look exactly like the blueprints, and after it's been lived in, it looks even less like the blueprints, to say nothing of how the house behaves when it's actually lived in at the location where it was actually built. The second thing that's wrong with the high concept of one gene makes one protein is that, in fact, many genes are involved in getting a piece of bodily work or bodily mischief done. This still looks like fate by DNA, only more complicated, but it's not. Three mechanisms affected by environmental factors determine how the blueprints get drawn, modified, and turned into someone's biological home. These mechanisms affect how DNA unwinds to build an organism. They are the action of hormones, symbiotic relationships with other organisms, and nutrient and biochemically induced DNA methylation. Allow me to point out that each of these is part of an organism's normal development. Organisms are adapted to respond to these influences in order to better lead a full, rich life. So the fundamental principle on which these new genetic tests are based is simply wrong. From an evolutionary standpoint, it makes perfect sense that our inherited traits, as written in our DNA, unfold in response to the environment in which we develop. In the case of mammals, that's as fetuses in the womb. It also happens, again, during sexual maturation after puberty. Once we're mature, we pass on to our children the nature that our environment has shaped. In addition, we ourselves affect the environments in which our children develop and mature, the environments that build their nature. Some recent research has demonstrated that the methylation process, for example, is what's called evolutionarily conserved, that is, passed from generation to generation, and occurs across all plant and animal species. In other words, the evolutionary process handed us the ability to adapt our nature to our environment. In a complementary fashion, all creatures work to change their environment to suit their needs, and in so doing, change their nature. Humans happen to be exceptionally talented at doing this. So nature or nurture is a false dichotomy. It's not one or the other, nor is it 50% nature and 50% nurture. Instead, who we are is a confluence of nature and nurture. We each have a nature, but it's what we have to work with, not what we're cursed to suffer, as reported to us by a test of little scientific merit. A transcript of this editorial is available on the blog at yourownhealthandfitness.org. I'm Jeffrey Fawcett. Take care of yourself.
Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett's an environmental economist, writer, and health educator who produces this show with me and is primary author of our book, Too Much Medicine, Not Enough Health. There is a Facebook page for that as well, and a Facebook page for Your Own Health and Fitness, which you can join. Now to today's topic and show, plant-based diets. Our guest is certified clinical nutritionist and journalist Kayla Daniels, has a PhD in nutritional sciences and anti-aging therapies, and is a board member of the Weston A. Price Foundation. She's the author of the book, The Whole Soy Story. So we're really thrilled to have you back, Kayla.
She'll be on in just a moment.
Okay, I guess there's a little bit of a lull in getting our guest up on the line. Kayla recently wrote an article in Wise Traditions magazine called Plants Bite Back. And it's the reason that we decided to have her on. The subtitle is The Surprising All-Natural Anti-Nutrients and Toxins in Plant Foods. And it illuminates the problems with all protein-based plant foods. So it turns out that the whole soy story isn't the whole story. It isn't only soy foods that have chemicals in them that block sort of mineral absorption, for instance. These foods, some of this you probably already know from hearing the show, that grains in particular have certain things in them. It's interesting to note that grains had to be hybridized before people could eat them. The hunter-gatherer cultures didn't eat grains because they were sort of mildly poisonous. And beans and legumes were very dicey also. In fact, soybeans, you know, obviously were developed over time, but can't be eaten raw in the field. They will make animals sick. They actually were originally developed as a cover crop for nitrogen fixing, putting nitrogen into the soil. So the function of all of these foods that happen to be rich in protein is that they are full of nitrogen and other wonderful things, but they are the germ that plants are propagated from. So I'm wondering what's happening with the guest. Are we unable to get her on the phone?
She's on.
Oh, are you there, Kayla?
Yes, I am.
I don't know how much you heard of what I was sort of going on about, but I was talking about the fact that the whole soy story isn't the whole story.
That's true. There's a whole lot of problems with vegetarian and vegan diets or plant-based diets besides soy.
Well, let me also start by saying that I don't want people to listen to the show and feel like just throwing their hands in the air and, you know, like there's no food that's safe. Because you can find things that are potentially wrong with every food source. From, you know, how it's raised and, you know, I mean, it goes on and on and on. You can find problems with everything. But there, in my mind, the particular problem here is that when people really rely on the plant foods that provide protein, that there's a problem. And I was explaining that it's partly because these are the germs that plants grow from. So they're very self-protective.
Absolutely. And one thing I always emphasize with people that if they have a rich and varied diet and don't see single foods as miracle foods, they tend not to get into trouble. It's when people overeat certain foods, whether it's soy or now one of the fashionable things is hemp, or whenever people overeat some of these foods, that's when they get into trouble.
Okay, so what is it about, I mean, let's have some basic principles that will help. I mean, the first principle is don't depend on all protein-based plant proteins for your vegetable, for your protein source. Don't eat them with the exclusion of other foods.
Right, that would be important. And plant-based proteins tend to have imbalances and deficiencies of some key amino acids. And then also when people rely on them, they tend to rely on processed soy or gluten products or other very processed protein products rather than the ones Mother Nature gave us, which do tend to be animal-based.
Okay, so why don't you just go ahead and talk to us about what it is that that's in these protein foods that interferes with even the absorption of the protein itself. What are the problems?
Starting
at the top. Well, go ahead.
Yeah, soybeans contain something called protease inhibitors. And we also find them in many other types of beans and in many other plant products as well as part of the protein component of them. And soybeans have more of them than other beans, so are more of a problem. And soybeans are also a problem because some people will eat soy several times a day, breakfast, lunch, dinner, and snack. And that's part of the problem, too. But protease inhibitors inhibit protease, and protease is the enzyme we need to digest protein well. So if we have a little soy once in a while, say at a vegetarian potluck or something, the pancreas is stressed that evening and then it heals up and it's not a problem. But if day after day we're putting protein into our guts, but also protease inhibitors, we're going to have some major digestive problems and a stressed out pancreas. And most of the studies on this have been done on the soybean, with the reason being they were USDA studies having to do with the attempt to include more soy protein in the diet of many different animals. So, you know, decades worth of studies by really good scientists with the USDA. And now that so many people are eating huge amounts of soy, we're starting to see some of those same problems crop up in people, namely the digestive problems, pancreatitis, and in worst case scenarios, an increase in pancreatic cancer, which has now gone up from number 5 to number 4 in terms of cancers that kill people. So those are some of the problems having to do with plant-based proteins. Some of the problems, though, are not what's in the plant itself. It has a lot to do with processing methods, manufacturing methods. So whenever we're talking about processed, packaged, and fast foods, we're often talking about processes that are high temperature, high pressure, use of chemical solvents such as hexane and other things that create carcinogens and create toxins as part of the process. So whenever you've got something that is not something you can eat naturally by just picking it off the plant and eating it, or simple cooking, whenever more elaborate processing gets involved, then the risks are increased.
I note that you mentioned that combining soy or corn oil and soy protein is not a good moment also, and that's interesting because a lot of these processed foods will have those oils in them.
That's right. So you have protein issues and you also have vegetable oil issues.
So what happens when you combine those?
Well, it's actually worse than double trouble because, you know, there's a multiplying effect. So when these things are bad for us and then they're in combination, they're infinitely worse. And any of these processed and packaged foods that people are finding in supermarkets, and for that matter in health food stores, that even in health food stores where there's the illusion that this stuff is done safely, it often is not. And many of the vegetable oils are particularly dangerous for us, whether they're the liquid form or whether they're partially hydrogenated.
We're listening to an interview with Akayla, K-A-A-Y-L-A, Daniel. She's a PhD and a certified nutritionist. She's author of The Whole Soy Story, but she has recently written an article in Wise Traditions magazine, which is published by the Weston A. Price Foundation, called Plants Bite Back, The Surprising All-Natural Anti-Nutrients and Toxins in Plant Foods. And this is Your Own Health and Fitness, and I'm Lena Berman. So, yeah, well, it's the interesting part of diets that that depend primarily on these vegetable protein foods is that they are, as you just pointed out, highly, highly processed foods. So it's kind of ironic that people who are trying to eat healthy and believe in whole foods are ending up kind of victims of the food industry again, where there's all kinds of sweetening agents and texturing agents and things. So there's a big argument about saving the planet here, and you might want to say a word about that before we go on to the other chemicals.
Yes, that's a very important issue because so many people believe that plant-based diets are the key to both personal and planetary health. But, you know, if you're getting these highly processed foods that are being shipped across the country or from other places in the world, and where they involve billion-dollar processing plants and so forth, this is not something that's good for the planet. And as a clinical nutritionist, I would argue they're not good for personal health either for a whole lot of reasons. And another thing, a lot of people really believe that if we just plant most of the acreage on the world with plant foods and we eat those rather than eat animals, that will help avoid starvation and hunger in many parts of the world. But the truth is that doesn't quite work out the way we imagine it would, because there are large areas of the world that are just not suitable for agriculture. And the only way you can force the growth of plants in those lands is with a lot of fertilizer, irrigation, pesticides, and a whole lot of things that are, in fact, terrible for the planet.
Yeah, actually, one of the dirtiest industries for the planet is rice production, ironically. It's really dreadful, the flooding, you know, the flooding of the fields and all of that. The other point is that these foods are represent foods that are being raised by enormous cartels. Very large industry is raising these foods. And people are frequently, there's a political issue in terms of the third world and in terms of them getting proper food. And part of the problem is that they've been tossed off their land, so they can't have an animal for milk, and they can't have chickens, and they can't grow their own foods. So they're getting imports, basically.
Yes, and whenever there's a disaster anywhere in the world, whether it's a tsunami or an earthquake or something else, the big businesses like the soy industry move in with all sorts of donations, and of course they get wonderful publicity for it, and in fact people need help. But even in their own literature, they're conceding that the reason they're doing that is they want people to become dependent on that kind of product. They want to get those products into those parts of the world, and what we need to be helping people with is getting back to cottage industries and small farms, small mixed-use farms, and helping them grow locally.
So the other thing I wanted to point out is that in the processing, one of the things that's really causing problems is the conversion of these foods into powders. People have a hard time understanding why these protein powders are not a good substitute, you know, in terms of protein. I mean, I have had clients who really can't eat animal protein for a variety of reasons that are, you know, that have to do with personal things, personal issues. And I've also seen situations where people are older people, like very elderly people, are having trouble consuming enough protein, and you want to get some extra amino acids into them. But I'm always really cautious about using these powders because of the way they're processed.
Yes, I have a lot of concerns about those as well. And, of course, the worst one is probably the soy protein isolate powders. But most whey protein shakes, the whey is not organic and its processing is not appropriate, and it goes right across the board. These are extremely artificial products. And the reason people have the idea is they're so healthy is everybody is being trained to think that real foods are dangerous for us. If people are thinking of an egg, they've got the idea in many cases that the egg white is good for us, but that the yolk is dangerous.
Yeah.
And if it's whole milk, they're thinking the skim milk part might be okay, but the fat is not. And, of course, what that creates is two products instead of one. If someone drinks whole milk, it's a very satisfying experience, and you buy one product. If you buy skim milk, well, guess what? Your body's still looking for the fat, and you're going to hit the ice cream section of the store.
Yeah, and you're
so
not going to...
that's a couple products.
Yeah, you're also not going to be absorbing your fat-soluble vitamins without
exactly.
the cholesterol from the eggs and the milk. And also milk, butterfat in milk, if they're fed on, if they're grazed animals, has a lot of conjugated linoleic acid, which is now being produced from soy sludge and put into capsules so people can take it because it reduces cancer risk. But it's in butterfat milk, you know, when animals are grazed, it's in their butterfat. So you don't need it from soy sludge. You can get it from the butterfat in your whole full fat.
And this is so typical, the idea we should drink something like skim milk and then we should take CLA as a supplement. And so it goes, more and more products rather than eating whole foods like Mother Nature gave us.
Mm. There's also some new research that uncovered something called soya toxin.
Yes, soya toxin is something similar to a lectin, which is an anti-nutrient we find in soybeans and other beans and other plant foods. And can really do some damage to the intestine and to us in general if it gets into the bloodstream. So that's just one of many, many of what we call anti-nutrients in plant foods.
Well, I noticed that the research was on clotting, that it increased clotting.
That's one of the things it can do. And you know, when you're gluing up your blood or you're causing clotting, you know, we need clotting in certain circumstances, of course, but we need to retain that ability to use properly.
Well, do we know what the mechanism is? Why is it the lectin? Is it like you said? It's like a lectin. Is it the lectin itself, which is? I'm surprised that it's causing clotting. It's it must be interfering with some other nutrient or something to do that.
Well, I'm not sure exactly what the mechanism is. I'd have to check the articles that I did when I did the article. You know, it's one of many anti-nutrients that we do find that go naturally in plant foods. And they would include the protease inhibitors, which we were talking about earlier. There's phytates, which interfere with mineral absorption. There's the lectins, which can contribute to clotting and allergic responses and digestive problems.
Mm-hmm.
There's saponins, which have a way of binding with cholesterol. Now, people think that that might be a good thing because they think they want to lower their cholesterol. But what that actually does is damage cells and the lining of the gut. So a problem there for many people. There's things called salicylates, which we find in many fruits, including things like blueberries, which we're being encouraged to eat.
Well, salicylates in and of themselves are not dangerous. It's that people tend to get a lot of salicylates from sources that they're not aware of, or if they take painkillers and stuff, they're getting salicylates. And you can, it's one of those things that if you overdo it, I mean, it's the case with all things that we eat and consume, that if you bombard the body with a single substance and the body is under any kind of stress at all, it's possible for the for that person to become sensitized, and you can suddenly become sensitive to salicylates because there's so many of them, you know, in our diet naturally, apples and, you know, various fruits and stuff. So when suddenly you're consuming them normally in foods, or maybe you become a smoothie junkie and you're having enormous quantities of fruit every day, and then you start taking aspirin for something, you may sort of top out your sensitivity to salicylates and develop a salicylate allergy, which then is hard because it restricts your diet.
Yes, I think that phrase you use, top out, is a very good one, because a healthy person eating a varied diet is going to be able to handle these things. They shouldn't become a problem. But when people get caught up in all the hype about this food and that food being a miracle food, and they limit their diet to a few things, that's when the problems start. And probably the one that people are most familiar with is developing a problem with wheat and gluten. And everybody's familiar with that. Now you go into a place like Whole Foods and there's all these special labels saying gluten-free, gluten-free. And that problem developed because of the types of wheat and the fact that a whole lot of people were what I would call breaditarians. You know, they're not just vegetarians, but it's bread and it's pasta and crackers and cookies and massive amounts of wheat, and then problems are very likely to develop.
So we're not saying that there's salicylates in wheat. What we're saying is that that sensitivity reaction is similar to what happens with people when they eat tons and tons of wheat, becoming sort of... The other thing, though, that's interesting about wheat, and wheat, of course, has lots of phytates, which are these things that bind, you know, might be good for removing metals from the body if you use it as a pharmacological agent, but for consumption all the time, you're binding up your minerals, which are sometimes metals. And in a menstruating woman who's still bleeding, you can experience a significant iron loss. It also louses up the calcium phosphorus stuff, so you're not getting access to your minerals, so your bones are at risk. You're not getting your proper nutrients, so that's a big problem with the grains. But I've heard from many people in my practice that when they travel abroad and they eat wheat, maybe in other places like Italy or someplace in a small town in Italy where the food may be grown in, we hope, a less genetically modified way, and maybe the wheat is less hybridized. You know, maybe it's closer to something, although grains had to be hybridized, but there's something about it that people feel that they have less allergies to the grains when they're eating them outside of the United States. And I don't know what that's about. Do you?
I'm not sure. It could be the way the breads are prepared. If there's more sourdough breads, that processing helps minimize the problems, for one thing. It could be more ancient flours, you know, rather than the standard hybrid. Or
yeah, might be less pesticides. It's possible also.
Could be it too. But, you know, getting back to what you were saying, that people may get overexposed to one of these kinds of things, and for some people it could be a salicylate problem, for some people it could be a wheat gluten problem, for some people it might be a nightshade problem. We're all different, but what I think people really don't understand is there are a lot of risks with plant foods. There are problems with plant foods, and we need to take them into account.
Well, I would hesitate to say that there's a problem that is extraordinary about all plant foods. I would say, this is my opinion, I'm popping off with my opinion here, Kayla, just to be clear, my opinion is that that the protein-based plants, the foods that people eat for protein, tend to be the ones that are the most irritating, even nuts, if they're not eaten properly, if they're not... You know, some people can do raw nuts. People have different sensitivities in my experience. Some people do better with raw things. Some people absolutely can't eat things that aren't cooked, and they discover this as time goes on. People are extraordinarily different, but there's just in terms of absorbing the proteins, as you've said, there's all these things that interfere, and people's digestion is an issue. So I always worry when people have compromised guts, when their bowels and their tummies are not happy and they're having lots of symptoms, that they're not absorbing any nutrients from these foods. But I think that if people eat vegetables and fruits in a sane way, you know, in their natural form, and they vary their diet, they rotate things around, that they're probably not going to be getting into trouble.
Yes, that's my experience. If people have an omnivorous diet and they vary the foods, they rarely get into trouble.
So some of the other things that, I just realized we should probably take a very brief musical break. So you're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm on the phone with Kayla, K-A-A-Y-L-A, Daniel. Her book is The Whole Soy Story. She's also written an interesting article, Plants Bite Back, The Surprising All-Natural Anti-Nutrients in and Toxins in Plant Foods. We're talking about plant-based diets, and we'll be back after this break. Won't you stay with us?
Butter, John. Keep that veggie burger off my plate. That ain't the same stuff I've been eating. I want the beef, man. Give me the real thing. Woo! I don't need no treadmill to go for a walk. Just take a walk around the neighborhood. The neighborhood got to talk. Oh, yeah. Give me a cup of that good old black coffee. And I don't want no decaf. Because it ain't the same thing. You know what I mean?
Welcome back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. There's information about Your Own Health and Fitness, our guests, our practice, a free stream of this week's show, our archive, CD copies, and lots more at yourownhealthandfitness.org. Our information number 707-874-2772, and you can email us at admin, at yourownhealthandfitness.org with everything spelled out, or you can join us on our Facebook pages, Too Much Medicine, Not Enough Health, and Your Own Health and Fitness. Kayla, do you want to give out your website?
My website is wholesoystory.com. And people can reach me through the website, and I also welcome new friends on Facebook and new followers on Twitter.
Oh, boy, you've even got Twitter going on there. Good going.
Thank you.
Okay, so I've by now forgotten what I was going to ask you, but I wanted to go back to some of these other problematic items that are in these plant-based proteins that are, you know, there to try to protect these propagating substances, creature, you know, they're little live things, from producing more, from reproducing and propagating themselves, and so they make themselves ever so slightly irritating. One of them, which is interesting, is oxalates, which everyone thinks is coming from vitamin C. So when people get kidney stones, they're always blaming vitamin C. And in fact, research on vitamin C, they brought it up to 10 grams and didn't see any rise above normal in the oxalates. So it isn't coming from vitamin C, but there are some vegetables.
Very much so. And the most famous ones are spinach and rhubarb. Now, most people don't eat rhubarb very often, certainly not all year long, but there are some health-conscious people who are eating great big spinach salads every day for lunch, and they can get into trouble from all that spinach. It made Popeye strong, but it can create damage to us because of the high oxalate content. And with men, the likeliest thing that could result would be a kidney stone problem. And with women, it's a nasty condition called vulvodynia, which makes sex difficult, if not impossible. And some women become so sensitive they can't even wear underwear. And it used to be considered something that was
hysterical.
Hysterical. That's well said. And it has been found to be, in fact, a very real problem. And there are websites having to do with how to help yourself if you got this condition. And one of the things is low oxalate diet. So besides no rhubarb and no spinach, soy is high in oxalates, surprisingly high in oxalates. Also peanuts. Mm. And, you know, for some people, they're whole food groups, especially if you're trying to do a plant-based diet.
What are some of the other ones? Do you remember?
Chocolate's probably a problem there. Especially if it's got peanuts in it, too.
Wow. It is really important. Well, of course, chocolates and nuts in general also increase people's outbreaks of herpes if they're, because they're full of arginine. So your arginine to lysine ratio gets skewed. That's why lysine works well. But it's also a good idea if you've got herpes brewing. And gosh, I hate to say how many people I see who do. A lot of people are infected. That when you get that ratio out of whack, you're going to have an outbreak along with some stress. So that's the reason for the lysine, but you can also help yourself by easing up on the chocolate and the nuts a little bit, which is sad because nuts are a wonderful fat source and a good food, and so is spinach. Spinach is just chock-a-block full of vitamin K, which is absolutely essential for proper vessel walls to be strong and for your it mediates clotting. It doesn't cause you to be clotty. It protects clotting mechanisms from operating properly. And it's very, very important. So I would say not to eliminate spinach unless you become sensitized to this and you have symptoms, but to balance it with other things and maybe, as Kayla said, not have it every day. I mean, you could go on a tear about all the things that can go wrong if people eat too much meat and don't eat anything else, too. People, when they're very attached to meat and not interested in vegetables, tend to skew the balance of their alkaline acid toward acid too much, as they would do if they ate too many grains as well. And the vegetables and the fruits are alkalizing, so that's very important. And they do provide some soluble fiber. In addition, when people eat huge, huge servings of meat, above 8 ounces at a serving, you're running the risk of raising your homocysteine levels. Even if you don't have a history in your family of having high homocysteine levels, your body has trouble converting methionine into glutathione, your detox pathways, and it will get stuck if you eat these great, big, huge amounts, you know, like people who go to these horrible restaurants and eat a pound of steak. That's a good way to get your blood to clot up pretty fast. So, and then, of course, it has to be ethically raised and as close to organic as you can get, grass-fed. Feeding animals grains is a crime. If their lives weren't ended early, they would die of that diet. So it's extremely unethical to do that. So it anything that you eat creates a problem. Anything that you eat creates the need for some consideration about what you're doing, and possible moderation. I would say not that you go hungry, but that you think about what it is, particularly if you've got gut problems.
I'd like to make a point about the homocysteine levels. Dr. Kilmer McCulley, who's known as the father of the homocysteine theory of heart disease, points out that there was a study, I can't remember if he did it or someone else did it, but it did indicate that vegetarians tended to have very high homocysteine levels, comparable to aged people.
Interesting.
So there's yet another potential problem with people on plant-based diets.
Well, you know, it might be, I'm thinking that maybe what's happening, and also homocysteine, I should say, is mediated to a great degree by very balanced supplement nutrient program that includes the right B vitamins, the B6, the folic acid, the B12, and then some trimethylglycine if there's a real issue, which is a methylation, it increases methylation. The point is to kick you forward through that pathway that goes to glutathione, not getting stuck at homocysteine, which is one of the metabolites that gets formed as you're going through the process of making glutathione from protein foods. But the reason that vegetarians might be high in homocysteine is because you're without substantial sulfur-containing amino acids, which are not so present in plant-based proteins. They're mostly in animal-based proteins, although you can add raw dairy, organic dairy, and eggs if you're not sensitive to those two foods. And you will complete the proteins of some of these beans that you might be eating, hopefully not soybeans, some of the other beans, perhaps some of the little beans, if that's what you need to do, or cheese, you know, will help. But it's probable that what's happening with vegetarians is they don't have sufficient amino acid balance to get through that detox pathway, and they get stuck. It's ironic.
It's really interesting about the sulfur-containing aminos in beans, and soybeans, of course, are what I research the most. Now, soybeans actually contain large quantities of cysteine, but the catch with that is we can't absorb it because it's tied up in those protease inhibitors we were talking about earlier. So just eating it's not going to work. And this is kind of a gross story, but when they did experiments with rats, they discovered that the rats would eat their own poop. Well, that's how they got their cysteine.
Yeah. No, I don't recommend that people try this at home.
Exactly.
Well, you know, it is true that we can see with our animal companions sometimes that they, if there's a nutrient problem, they'll start eating that and other bizarre things. They'll develop pica, where they'll start chewing on rubber and things like that. And that's usually a sign that there's a nutrient problem. But, yeah, it is interesting because we think of vegetarians as not being people who will have a heart attack because of the conventional model for how heart disease develops and how flawed that is. We might want to say something in addition to what we've been talking about, all these different anti-nutrients in these plant-based proteins, something about what happens during fetal development in families where the parents feel very strongly, ethically, to be vegetarians or maybe vegans. What might be going on in terms of development for the fetus in that
situation?
There are
definitely risks there. And with soybeans, say if a vegan mom is eating a whole lot of soy as both a meat and dairy replacement early in pregnancy, if it's a little boy baby, that little boy may not be able to produce enough testosterone. And all sorts of problems can develop where the boy has been feminized early on in his fetal development because testosterone just wasn't there. And the testosterone would have been interfered with by the estrogens in the soybeans. And so there's a greater risk of a birth defect called hypospadias. And that is a problem in which the opening of the penis is not at the end, but it's somewhere underneath. And that is a feminized little boy. And besides soy, some of the problems could be environmental estrogens and the estrogens in plastics and pesticides and some of these other things, too. And the European Commission right now is looking into this, and they do consider soy one of the likely causes in the increase of this birth defect.
The other problem with soy estrogens is they are non-native estrogens. We don't make these in our body, so they vary slightly in their molecular structure, and they tend to occupy our receptor sites in place of our native estrogens. And men and women both have estrogens. Men use estrogen that's converted from their testosterone, and it's part of the way that their brain works, is the brain depends on some estrogen to make it work. I know the irony there is wonderful. I love it. But what happens is that the soy estrogens tend to knock those off. And I think initially people thought, oh, this is great because, you know, estrogens are bad and they cause all these health problems and stuff. Well, it turns out that estrogens are very protective. They just have to be balanced with the other hormones. They don't like to be alone, so they want progesterone and even testosterone around. But when you knock your native estrogens off the receptors in favor of the soy estrogens, you get very bad cognitive decline, and this has shown up in study after study of you know, middle-aged men and later, you know, autopsying their brains in Japan, Japanese Hawaiian men that ate lots of tofu and soy. Again, you know, we're not saying you can never eat these foods. We're saying be prudent about how you eat them. And also, you mentioned, of course, that the fermentation is also very critical. If you're going to eat soy, eat it fermented.
And a variety of foods, and limit the soy, even the fermented soy. Like I certainly can recommend eating miso soup or natto or tempeh a couple times a week. And that's fine. It's when people get into drinking soy milk several times a day, eating soy energy bars, soy shake powders, veggie burgers. People can very easily eat too much.
You're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman with Kayla Daniels, K-A-A-Y-L-A Daniel. Her website is the wholesoystory.com, I believe, right?
That's right.
Mm-hmm. And we're talking to her about an article that she wrote called Plants Bite Back, the surprising all-natural anti-nutrients and toxins in plant foods. Let's go back to the salicylate issue, because I actually found this distressing, because so many fruits, I mean, even if you have two fruits a day, you could be consuming quite a bit of salicylate. So, but there are some fruits that are lower, so you could rotate those in just to protect yourself. What are the low salicylate foods?
Among fruits, apples, just the golden delicious apples. A banana is low in salicylates. Lime, papayas, pear, they're lower. But of course, something like banana is high in sugar, so yep. You want to be a little cautious about eating too many bananas.
Well, yeah, I mean it's fine to have one or maybe two a day if that's your fruit for the day, but. I still think that it's good for people to eat berries because they have remarkable protective effects for the eyes, for the circulatory system, and they also they tend not to cause a blood sugar spike. So
right.
People who are sensitive to sugar. So I don't think people should abandon them. Again, the concept here is to vary your diet and to rotate your foods, whether you're food allergic or sensitive or not. If you're unlucky enough to be food sensitive, you're already eating a very limited diet. So if you're not, if you don't know yourself to be sensitive, it's prudent to rotate what you're eating. And of course, I think to some extent, eating seasonally is probably smart from this perspective as well.
Very much so. And having to do with fruits and salicylates, if the fruits have been ripened properly, the salicylate content will be lower.
Mm.
So in a way, that's the plant's way of protecting itself until the fruit has ripened.
Mm-hmm.
And that's also encouraging us to do what we really should be doing anyway, which is buying fresh and buying locally.
Right, from farmers markets and stuff where you get actual ripened fruit. Let's talk a little bit about fiber supplements and gastrointestinal health. You kind of went on a slight tear, and I tend to agree with you. People are very concerned about getting enough fiber. And, you know, I always point out that if you are eating vegetables and fruit, you're getting soluble fiber. But and usually when people are constipated, you're dealing with a nutrient problem. There's not enough vitamin C on board. Maybe you've got a magnesium deficiency. Both of those will loosen the bowel significantly. But people do, you know, being sold fiber supplements and being told that this will prevent them from having irritable bowel and cancer and all the rest of it. So why don't you give us your ideas about that?
Well, like so many of these other things, when we're being hyped something as being healthy, in many cases it's quite the opposite. And people actually believe, because it's been marketed so heavily and so convincingly, that we should be eating a lot of things that we cannot even digest because it's supposedly good for us. And this defies common sense, but just about everybody believes it anymore. And it does cause all sorts of digestion problems, bloating. It's very irritating to the entire gastrointestinal system. It can contribute to a lot of problems.
Give us some examples.
Well, it can contribute to any...
No, the foods.
Oh, foods. Well, some of the worst would be things like bran, you know, the completely artificial ones. But people who are encouraged to, say, start off with a high-fiber breakfast cereal, I mean, they're getting more fiber from just that than they should have in a whole day. And then people are being encouraged to add all sorts of high-fiber things to everything, you know, beans to this and bran to that. And
well, we've got things like psyllium, which up until very recently wasn't even available organically, so it was highly sprayed. There's psyllium. People are using flaxseed meal as a fiber supplement. And some people swear that it makes them feel better, so it's very confusing for people. There's also slippery elm, which is slightly different because it's more of an herb, and it does have an emulsant effect on the
mm-hmm.
gut, and I think maybe not as much of a problem. It tends to heal, and it creates a nice emollient for the gut. But I think that the, you know, all of the psyllium and, like you say, but when you say bran, artificial bran, what do you mean by artificial? Isn't it extracted from wheat?
Well, it's extracted from a number of things, but it's rather artificial when it's, first of all, when it's taken apart from where it comes from. You know, whenever we're talking about fractionating products, there's some problems there. But we cannot digest things like that, and it's being used to fill us up. It's indigestible. I mean, that's sort of the point of it, that you can fill up on something you can't digest. Therefore, the idea is you won't get fat on it.
Well, and also it supposedly sweeps out your colon, because the colon is this fecid thing. So you, I'm not fecid, that's the wrong word. Yeah, it is right, fecid. That you, you know, it's dirty and you've got to sweep it out and you've got to do colonics and things and get all that stuff out of there. And I'm always going, guys, there's an ecology in your bowel. It's designed for that, and it has all kinds of symbiotic creatures living in it that can be helped along by eating fermented foods like sauerkraut and things like that.
Yes, that is really the way to help somebody with constipation is to include more of the naturally cultured foods like sauerkraut. And good probiotics, foods that contain probiotics, things like kefir or a properly made yogurt or a kimchi and sauerkraut and these kind of products will help with the microflora in the gut. And when we've got a healthy microflora, we're more likely to have good bowel movement.
Now, some people are dreadfully allergic to dairy. Even the raw dairy doesn't quite work. But the other thing is that with Acidophilus actually is formed with cabbage. You do get the same culture on cabbage as you do in the milk. I understood that if you do a really good job on your kefir or your yogurt and it's really sour, it might actually have killed the creatures and you might not be getting it. Is that not your experience?
That would not be my experience. Oh. It usually gets more powerful when it gets more sour.
Okay, so people do ingest the culture itself. They do get that.
And when Dennis Burkett went to Africa, what we hear about that is he thought the natives had very good bowel movements because of all the fiber. But the research actually suggests that they were also getting all sorts of probiotics and eating many cultured vegetables and things, and that would also have encouraged them to have good bowel movement.
Well, it's culturing vegetables is one of the ways to remove the potential problems. Like cabbage, raw cabbage is a goitrogen. It's hard on the thyroid. It's a little inhibitory if you eat lots and lots and lots of coleslaw, which is great stuff. I love it. But, you know, lots of raw cabbage is, you know, every day would be a problem. But you ferment the cabbage and you get rid of that stuff.
Yes, that's very
much. And you preserve it.
Getting back to the wisdom of our ancestors, the proper preparation of vegetables, the proper preparation of grains and beans and so forth. And the modern way is quick and fast and packaged, and those products contain a lot of hazards.
So if people want to throw caution to the wind and they want to eat grains, for instance, and they're not allergic to them, they're not getting inconsolable depression and anxiety or gut symptoms from eating grains, and they want to eat these whole rough grains because here's another food source, you know, they're eating maybe an omnivore, you know, they're omnivores, they're eating everything, but they want maybe to have some grains, and I've seen some people who tolerate them. How would you prepare them? How would you recommend this?
Dr. Weston Price, when he went to a remote Swiss village, he found that they were eating quite a lot of this really robust rye bread, and it had been soaked and it fermented for quite a long period of time. And that kind of product can be incredibly healthy if we're not already reactive. Now, there's the catch, because a lot of people have become sensitive to wheat and gluten because of many years of excessive eating of improperly prepared products. Mm-hmm. And likewise, many people have become very sensitive to pasteurized supermarket dairy products and so now can't tolerate anything.
Exactly.
So there are some complications there in terms of what people tolerate today.
Well, and then we do have tubers for people who are not starch sensitive. And you know who you are because, you know, someone said, how do you know if you're starch sensitive? I said, you take your clothes off and you stand in front of a full-length mirror. and you'll know whether you're starch sensitive, because if you're not starch sensitive, you'll be lean, you won't have a lot of body fat, and you certainly won't have extra weight gain in the tummy. So those lucky people, I'm not one of them, who can eat starches, there are sweet potatoes and yams and winter squash, and these are great foods. I mean, are they not?
I think they are, and again, I recommend a richly varied diet.
Okay. So in terms of, what did I want to go back to, recommendations for people? The other thing I think we should say is if people have a lot of gut problems, the other thing that really works well is broths, is cooking animal protein that's has bones. I think you can do this with chicken as well as beef, but anything with bones, and you add just a splash of vinegar to the water when you cook it, creates this wonderful broth. And if you drink some of that broth on a daily basis, it calms the gut down and heals the gut. It's interesting.
Yes, I put almost all my clients on bone broth. And you can make it, of course, with chicken, turkey, fish, lamb, beef, just about anything. And you think bones and a little vinegar and water. You can certainly add vegetables and spices according to your preference and your favorite recipes. Just alter it to include the bones and a little vinegar.
What about lemon juice instead of vinegar? Does that work as well? Isn't it just...
You can do that, yeah. Or if you want to be like Julia Child, you can use wine. That's splendid as well.
Oh, my. Just images of her. Just we don't have time for me to go on a tear about it. We just saw an old thing of her going, she was hacking a fish to pieces on the table. It was quite funny, going, you take the cleaver and you just hack it to bits and you do it. It was wonderful. I just couldn't resist. all right. We're running a little shy on time. If people want to read your article, is it online somewhere, or do they have to become members of the Weston A. Price Foundation? Is there a way to get hold of this article somewhere?
Yes, they can find it on the WestonAPrice.org website. And I would very much encourage people to become members, because we're a grassroots organization, and we need your support.
And your website, again, is thewholesoystory.com.
That's right, and people can contact me through that and also through Facebook or Twitter.
And the book, of course, is available in various places and is quite a read. Usually when people are shocked that there might be a problem with soy, I send them to the book. And, you know, it's very balanced. I mean, you're not, as you say, if people want to eat some fermented miso soup, a few days a week, this is not a problem. So I do think it's a worthy thing for people to pick up if they're interested in the topic.
And the larger theme of that book is not even about soy. It's about dirty little secrets of the food processing industry, mm-hmm. with soy being the example. But whenever we start hearing about some new food doing miracle things, you know, whether it's chocolate or hemp or whatever is the food of the moment, our ears should go up and we should have our radar out, because usually there's a reason that, yeah, we're suddenly hearing about it.
You bet. Kayla Daniels, I want to thank you so much for this time with us. Thank you again.
Thank you.
And I want to thank you all for listening. I'm Lena Berman. There's information about your own health and fitness, our guest, our practice, a free stream of this week's show, our archive, CD copies, lots more at yourownhealthandfitness.org. You can email us at admin@yourownhealthandfitness.org, all spelled out. Or you can call us at 707-874-2772. Your Own Health and Fitness is produced by Lena Berman and Jeff Fawcett, PhD. Remember, being informed not only protects your health, it protects your freedom.